University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Session 2010. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Why does Anton need to travel to the airport to obtain some cash?
I need to change some money.
It's after 6 o'clock, Anton. The banks will be shut. There is a cash machine at the crossroads.
Oh dear, I've got traveller's checks with me, not a cash card.
Then the airport is the best place. You can change your traveller's checks there. It's only 2 stations away on the metro.
I need to change some money.
It's after 6 o'clock, Anton. The banks will be shut. There is a cash machine at the crossroads.
Oh dear, I've got traveller's checks with me, not a cash card.
Then the airport is the best place. You can change your traveller's checks there. It's only 2 stations away on the metro.
Question 2. Where exactly in C Road is the youth hostel?
Could you give us directions to the youth hostel, please? It's in C Road.
Oh, that's easy. But you are still quite a long way away. Follow the main road until you come to a sports field. Right opposite there is C Road. And, of course, it leads to the sea. C Road is at least 2 kilometres long, though, and the youth hostel is at the end of it on the promenade facing the sea.
Could you give us directions to the youth hostel, please? It's in C Road.
Oh, that's easy. But you are still quite a long way away. Follow the main road until you come to a sports field. Right opposite there is C Road. And, of course, it leads to the sea. C Road is at least 2 kilometres long, though, and the youth hostel is at the end of it on the promenade facing the sea.
Question 3. When is Sandeep planning to drive to the party and why?
Hello, Sandeep. Are you coming to my party tomorrow evening? I know it's a long way for you to drive.
Well, it's about 200 kilometres from my house to yours. The weekend traffic will be terrible, so what I plan to do is to come very early in the morning. Then I can spend the whole day with you before the party begins.
Hello. Hello, Sandeep. Are you coming to my party tomorrow evening? I know it's a long way for you to drive.
Well, it's about 200 kilometres from my house to yours. The weekend traffic will be terrible, so what I plan to do is to come very early in the morning. Then I can spend the whole day with you before the party begins.
Question 4. Give two places where Shiraz might be able to find help.
Oh dear, I've got a puncture in my bicycle tyre. Where do you think I can get it repaired?
Perhaps at that garage just over there, Shiraz. If they can't help, they might know where you can get help. There is a bicycle shop in the village.
Oh dear, I've got a puncture in my bicycle tyre. Where do you think I can get it repaired?
Perhaps at that garage just over there, Shiraz. If they can't help, they might know where you can get help. There is a bicycle shop in the village.
Question 5. What makes a pizza more expensive?
Let's organise a group of us to go to that new pizza restaurant in town.
That's a good idea. How much do their pizzas cost?
I read the price list yesterday. A large cheese and tomato pizza is £6.99, and the price goes up by 50 pence if you add meat or fish.
I see. Then the same size pizza will cost £7.49.
Let's organise a group of us to go to that new pizza restaurant in town.
That's a good idea. How much do their pizzas cost?
I read the price list yesterday. A large cheese and tomato pizza is £6.99, and the price goes up by 50 pence if you add meat or fish.
I see. Then the same size pizza will cost £7.49.
Question 6. Which two items must candidates take to the examination?
Here are the exam instructions for tomorrow morning. All candidates should be seated by 8:30 a.m. Bring some identification to the examination, a passport or college card with a photograph on it to prove your identity to the invigilator. And don't forget your candidate number. No bags may be taken into the examination room. Please leave them at reception. Here are the exam instructions for tomorrow morning. All candidates should be seated by 8:30 a.m. Bring some identification to the examination, a passport or college card with a photograph on it to prove your identity to the invigilator. And don't forget your candidate number. No bags may be taken into the examination room. Please leave them at reception.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about a sport called bicycle polo, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Sports Hour. Today we continue to focus on unusual sports, with bicycle polo. Whatever is that, you may well ask. Isabel Bernier is our bicycle polo expert and is here to explain this sport to us.
Traditional polo is played on horseback all over the world. There are two teams, and each rider carries a long polo stick which reaches to the ground. The players use their polo sticks to hit a ball towards a goal.
Just like hockey.
Yes. Polo is a very popular sport, and bicycle polo is very similar, but...
The horses are replaced by bicycles?
Exactly. The players all ride bikes, and the object of the game is still to score by hitting a ball into a goal using a long stick.
Are the rules the same as for horseback polo?
There are a few extra rules for bicycle polo. For example, all players have to wear specially adapted safety helmets, as it's much faster and more dangerous than traditional polo. Players are not allowed to put a foot on the ground while hitting the ball.
The sticks must be shorter too, as the rider is nearer the ground on a bicycle than on the back of a horse.
And that is exactly what makes the sport so much faster and more dangerous. It's much easier to get hit over the head by a stick. Our polo pitches are usually grass, not tarmac, so at least players have a soft landing if they are knocked off their bikes. Some clubs choose to play on hard surfaces, and this makes the game very, very fast and much more dangerous.
It sounds like one of these new sports to me, a kind of extreme polo, or a more dangerous form of hockey.
But bicycle polo is not modern at all. It was included in the Olympics in 1908. Ireland won the gold medal on that occasion.
Really?
Yes. And there is a campaign to bring bicycle polo back into the next Olympic Games in 2012.
So how many people are there in a bicycle polo team?
Four. And it's not as easy as you think. The players need to stay in low gear to be able to coordinate bike, stick and ball.
Is there a special uniform?
Oh, no. Shorts and T-shirt. And, of course, a safety helmet.
So, how does a game start off?
Two teams of four line up on their bikes. The umpire throws in the ball, and each half of the match lasts for 7 minutes. It's just like playing football or hockey. The team with the most goals wins, and offside and penalty rules apply.
And do bicycle polo teams exist all over the world? I've never heard of them.
Yes, the World Championships are held every December. In 2008, for example, the venue was in Argentina.
Do you need more players? Presumably anyone who can ride a bike can have a go.
Yes, indeed. We would like to encourage everyone to have a go at bicycle polo. All you need is an old bicycle. The older the better, as you won't want to damage your bright, shiny new one. Then look up your nearest team on www.bicyclepolo.com and come along to a practice session and join in.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to Sports Hour. Today we continue to focus on unusual sports with bicycle polo. Whatever is that, you may well ask. Isabel Bernier is our bicycle polo expert and is here to explain this sport to us.
Traditional polo is played on horseback all over the world. There are two teams, and each rider carries a long polo stick, which reaches to the ground. The players use their polo sticks to hit a ball towards a goal.
Just like hockey.
Yes. Polo is a very popular sport, and bicycle polo is very similar, but...
The horses are replaced by bicycles?
Exactly. The players all ride bikes, and the object of the game is still to score by hitting a ball into a goal using a long stick.
Are the rules the same as for horseback polo?
There are a few extra rules for bicycle polo. For example, all players have to wear specially adapted safety helmets, as it's much faster and more dangerous than traditional polo. Players are not allowed to put a foot on the ground while hitting the ball.
The sticks must be shorter too, as the rider is nearer the ground on a bicycle than on the back of a horse.
And that is exactly what makes the sport so much faster and more dangerous. It's much easier to get hit over the head by a stick. Our polo pitches are usually grass, not tarmac, so at least players have a soft landing if they are knocked off their bikes. Some clubs choose to play on hard surfaces, and this makes the game very, very fast and much more dangerous.
It sounds like one of these new sports to me, a kind of extreme polo, or a more dangerous form of hockey.
But bicycle polo is not modern at all. It was included in the Olympics in 1908. Ireland won the gold medal on that occasion.
Really?
Yes. And there is a campaign to bring bicycle polo back into the next Olympic Games in 2012.
So how many people are there in a bicycle polo team?
Four. And it's not as easy as you think. The players need to stay in low gear to be able to coordinate bike, stick and ball.
Is there a special uniform?
Oh, no. Shorts and T-shirt. And, of course, a safety helmet.
So, how does a game start off?
Two teams of four line up on their bikes. The umpire throws in the ball, and each half of the match lasts for 7 minutes. It's just like playing football or hockey. The team with the most goals wins, and offside and penalty rules apply.
And do bicycle polo teams exist all over the world? I've never heard of them.
Yes. The World Championships are held every December. In 2008, for example, the venue was in Argentina.
Do you need more players? Presumably anyone who can ride a bike can have a go.
Yes, indeed. We would like to encourage everyone to have a go at bicycle polo. All you need is an old bicycle. The older the better, as you won't want to damage your bright, shiny new one. Then look up your nearest team on www.bicyclepolo.com and come along to a practice session and join in.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following interview with a trainee stone carver and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Welcome to our career programme. Today we're going to talk to Adele B, who is an apprentice stone carver. That means that she's training to become a stonemason. Adele is employed by the Stone Centre, which raises awareness of this age-old trade by hosting exhibitions and providing information. Adele, what actually does your job involve?
I'm a stone carver. I work anywhere that people need stone carved to a specific shape and design. For example, in old houses, in churches, or temples, or graveyards, or in town centres and public gardens, perhaps for fountains and monuments. I could go on and on with the list of places where you can see the art of a stonemason.
Have you always wanted to carve stone since you were a young child?
Oh, no. I went to university and studied languages and history. After I obtained my degree, I worked on several restoration projects in old stone buildings, and that was how I got interested.
So you are a trainee?
Yes. I'm still learning how to carve stone, and will not become a qualified stonemason for 3 more years. At the moment, for example, I'm helping to restore the stonework on a big old house, and I'm living on site there.
Do you earn a lot?
Hardly anything as an apprentice, but I do have job satisfaction.
Would you say that there are any disadvantages to the job?
Only if you're scared of heights. At my interview for the apprenticeship, I had to climb some scaffolding. Often we work on rooftops, you see.
So tell us about a typical day's work.
I begin work early, at dawn, in fact, because I need to make the most of the daylight hours. I'm working on a 400-year-old house, and for the last 6 days I have been carving a large letter S, which will go on its roof.
That sounds a heavy job.
A stonemason has to be strong. There are often pieces of stone to lift. Sometimes I help to get the stone into workable-sized blocks. Sometimes I work on carving, and sometimes, but very rarely, I'll take on the role of fixer, putting a finished piece securely into place.
How do you actually carve the stone? Is it like carving wooden animals from pieces of wood?
It's the same principle, but stone is different to work with than wood, and we use special tools for the actual carving.
What are your tools called?
We use the same stone carving tools now as stonemasons did hundreds of years ago. A mallet, which is a sort of heavy hammer to hit the stone with, and a chisel to cut fine pieces and finish the stone shape. The aim is to have a finished piece of carved stone without any tool marks on it, but that takes a lot of time.
You mean that if you work quickly, you're likely to leave hammer or chisel marks on the stone?
Yes. In the olden days, an unmarked piece of stone was a sign of wealth, because the employer had obviously paid a stonemason to take time over finishing the stonework.
Do stonemasons autograph their work, like artists?
Yes, some do. I don't, but I'm not a master craftsman yet. Autographing pieces actually started because years ago a stonemason got paid for the quantity of pieces cut, for every piece of stone with his sign on it.
I'd like to have a go at carving some stone.
You can. Come along to our stone carving day at the Stone Centre. You'll be able to learn about stone cutting techniques and create your own piece of work. Call us on 02357 969 511 or visit our website www.thestonecentre.com for further details.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Welcome to our career programme. Today we're going to talk to Adele B, who is an apprentice stone carver. That means that she's training to become a stonemason. Adele is employed by the Stone Centre, which raises awareness of this age-old trade by hosting exhibitions and providing information. Adele, what actually does your job involve?
I'm a stone carver. I work anywhere that people need stone carved to a specific shape and design. For example, in old houses, in churches, or temples, or graveyards, or in town centres and public gardens, perhaps for fountains and monuments. I could go on and on with the list of places where you can see the art of a stonemason.
Have you always wanted to carve stone since you were a young child?
Oh, no. I went to university and studied languages and history. After I obtained my degree, I worked on several restoration projects in old stone buildings, and that was how I got interested.
So you are a trainee?
Yes. I'm still learning how to carve stone, and will not become a qualified stonemason for 3 more years. At the moment, for example, I'm helping to restore the stonework on a big old house, and I'm living on site there.
Do you earn a lot?
Hardly anything as an apprentice, but I do have job satisfaction.
Would you say that there are any disadvantages to the job?
Only if you're scared of heights. At my interview for the apprenticeship, I had to climb some scaffolding. Often we work on rooftops, you see.
So tell us about a typical day's work.
I begin work early, at dawn, in fact, because I need to make the most of the daylight hours. I'm working on a 400-year-old house, and for the last 6 days I have been carving a large letter S, which will go on its roof.
That sounds a heavy job.
A stonemason has to be strong. There are often pieces of stone to lift. Sometimes I help to get the stone into workable-sized blocks. Sometimes I work on carving, and sometimes, but very rarely, I'll take on the role of fixer, putting a finished piece securely into place.
How do you actually carve the stone? Is it like carving wooden animals from pieces of wood?
It's the same principle, but stone is different to work with than wood, and we use special tools for the actual carving.
What are your tools called?
We use the same stone carving tools now as stonemasons did hundreds of years ago. A mallet, which is a sort of heavy hammer to hit the stone with, and a chisel to cut fine pieces and finish the stone shape. The aim is to have a finished piece of carved stone without any tool marks on it, but that takes a lot of time.
You mean that if you work quickly, you're likely to leave hammer or chisel marks on the stone?
Yes. In the olden days, an unmarked piece of stone was a sign of wealth, because the employer had obviously paid a stonemason to take time over finishing the stonework.
Do stonemasons autograph their work, like artists?
Yes, some do. I don't, but I'm not a master craftsman yet. Autographing pieces actually started because years ago a stonemason got paid for the quantity of pieces cut, for every piece of stone with his sign on it.
I'd like to have a go at carving some stone.
You can. Come along to our stone carving day at the Stone Centre. You'll be able to learn about stone cutting techniques and create your own piece of work. Call us on 02357 969 511 or visit our website www.thestonecentre.com for further details.
That is the end of question 8. In a moment, you will hear question 9. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about ballpoint pens and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Inventors Weekly. Recently, the ballpoint pen, or biro as it's often called, celebrated its 72nd birthday. Unbelievable, isn't it? Here is Dieter Strech to tell us about the history of this useful item.
People certainly think a ballpoint pen or biro is useful. 15 million are sold worldwide each day.
Every day?
And that is a 2% increase on last year's sales figures.
I'm amazed at those figures. People said there would be no need for pens when computers and digital equipment were introduced.
Well, it seems there is more demand for them than ever. Do you know that in the last 60 years, one manufacturer alone has sold more than 100 billion pens all over the world? That is enough ink to draw a line to the moon and back 320,000 times.
So how was the humble ballpoint invented?
By a Hungarian gentleman who gave his name to the first ever ballpoint pen company. He kept breaking the nibs of his ink pens. One day, he saw some ink in a printer's shop which dried as soon as it touched the paper. The inventor realized that it would be possible to translate this type of quick-drying ink into a form of instant pen. The quick-drying printing ink was too thick to be used in a fountain pen, so the inventor sought the help of his brother, who was a chemist.
And the ballpoint was born?
Yes. After several experiments, the brothers replaced the nib, that's the tip of the fountain pen, with a tiny ball bearing, which spread the ink evenly on the paper. They started selling this ballpoint in June 1938. The first pens cost £27 each.
Oh dear, I would expect to buy one for 27 pence now.
Yes, luckily the Air Force heard about this and needed pens which would write under pressure at high altitudes.
Fountain pens leaked when used high up in the sky, of course.
They ordered 30,000 of the new ballpoints, and so the mass production of ballpoint pens began. By 1965, governments even approved the pen for use in schools.
But there were problems, weren't there?
That's right. There was much controversy. Critics said the ballpoint would ruin handwriting skills. But actually, it has enabled easy writing. There is no need for ink bottles, and ballpoints save so much time.
And is the pen we buy today still the same as the 1938 version?
Basically, it is still made to the same design. Nowadays, the barrel is hexagonal in shape to provide a better grip. And there are air holes in the body of the pen to ensure a good flow of ink.
Are they easy to manufacture?
A modern ballpoint pen takes up to 60 hours to make. The ballpoint tip itself is less than 1 millimetre in diameter and is as hard as a diamond.
So they are actually quite complex items.
Yes, but we don't treat them with due respect for their complexity. We are always losing pens and leaving pens behind.
I understood that ballpoint pens are not toxic and that they don't damage the environment when empty. Is that right?
Well, yes, they wouldn't cause significant damage. And you can always spend a little more than your 27 pence and buy a refillable ballpoint pen, which will last you forever.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to Inventors Weekly. Recently, the ballpoint pen, or biro, as it's often called, celebrated its 72nd birthday. Unbelievable, isn't it? Here is Dieter Strech to tell us about the history of this useful item.
People certainly think a ballpoint pen or biro is useful. 15 million are sold worldwide each day.
Every day?
And that is a 2% increase on last year's sales figures.
I'm amazed at those figures. People said there would be no need for pens when computers and digital equipment were introduced.
Well, it seems there is more demand for them than ever. Do you know that in the last 60 years, one manufacturer alone has sold more than 100 billion pens all over the world? That is enough ink to draw a line to the moon and back 320,000 times.
So how was the humble ballpoint invented?
By a Hungarian gentleman who gave his name to the first ever ballpoint pen company. He kept breaking the nibs of his ink pens. One day, he saw some ink in a printer's shop, which dried as soon as it touched the paper. The inventor realized that it would be possible to translate this type of quick-drying ink into a form of instant pen. The quick-drying printing ink was too thick to be used in a fountain pen, so the inventor sought the help of his brother, who was a chemist.
And the ballpoint was born?
Yes. After several experiments, the brothers replaced the nib, that's the tip of the fountain pen, with a tiny ball bearing, which spread the ink evenly on the paper. They started selling this ballpoint in June 1938. The first pens cost £27 each.
Oh dear, I would expect to buy one for 27 pence now.
Yes. Luckily, the Air Force heard about this and needed pens which would write under pressure at high altitudes.
Fountain pens leaked when used high up in the sky, of course.
They ordered 30,000 of the new ballpoints, and so the mass production of ballpoint pens began. By 1965, governments even approved the pen for use in schools.
But there were problems, weren't there?
That's right. There was much controversy. Critics said the ballpoint would ruin handwriting skills. But actually, it has enabled easy writing. There is no need for ink bottles, and ballpoints save so much time.
And is the pen we buy today still the same as the 1938 version?
Basically, it is still made to the same design. Nowadays, the barrel is hexagonal in shape to provide a better grip, and there are air holes in the body of the pen to ensure a good flow of ink.
Are they easy to manufacture?
A modern ballpoint pen takes up to 60 hours to make. The ballpoint tip itself is less than 1 millimetre in diameter and is as hard as a diamond.
So they are actually quite complex items.
Yes. But we don't treat them with due respect for their complexity. We are always losing pens and leaving pens behind.
I understood that ballpoint pens are not toxic and that they don't damage the environment when empty. Is that right?
Well, yes, they wouldn't cause significant damage. And you can always spend a little more than your 27 pence and buy a refillable ballpoint pen, which will last you forever.
That is the end of question 9. In a moment, you will hear question 10. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 10. Listen to the following talk about a museum of art, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the talk twice.
A new museum of art has opened in Qatar, the first of its kind in the Middle East. It's situated just off the newly developed seafront and has been purposely built on its own museum island, so that it will never become hidden by any future buildings which may surround it. This isolated position gives the museum its great importance. It will transform the area into a cultural and tourist destination for people who are interested in art. Indeed, many art professors were among the guests at the gallery's magnificent opening ceremony last November. There were fireworks too, and a performance by a famous cellist to mark the occasion. The museum building was designed by the veteran architect Mr. Pei, then aged 91. He's famous for designing a glass pyramid for a renowned Paris art gallery. Mr. Pei first undertook much research into local building styles before designing the museum, and he modelled it on the shape of a North African sandstone fortress. He built with square and octagonal limestone blocks, creating 3,800 square metres of gallery space around a central courtyard. A tower with a dome rises above this middle area and lets in light through many windows. The architect would like his museum building to be regarded as a work of art in itself, as a sculpture perhaps. Inside, the museum houses 800 manuscripts, textiles, ceramics, and other works of art, which have been collected from around the world during the last 20 years. The origin of some of the artefacts is Spain, Iran, or Egypt. Other items come from Turkey and India, and some also from Central Asia. Two works of art are on display in the entrance hall: a bronze fountainhead in the shape of a deer, and a brass plate from Persia. Both of these exhibits date from the 10th century. The curator of the museum states that most of the works of art in the collection have a function or a practical use. It is his hope that the museum will become a centre for research and education into the history of art in the area. Two more art museums, both connected with world-famous art galleries, are also planned as future building projects further along the coast.
Now you will hear the talk again.
A new museum of art has opened in Qatar, the first of its kind in the Middle East. It's situated just off the newly developed seafront and has been purposely built on its own museum island so that it will never become hidden by any future buildings which may surround it. This isolated position gives the museum its great importance. It will transform the area into a cultural and tourist destination for people who are interested in art. Indeed, many art professors were among the guests at the gallery's magnificent opening ceremony last November. There were fireworks too, and a performance by a famous cellist to mark the occasion. The museum building was designed by the veteran architect Mr. Pei, then aged 91. He's famous for designing a glass pyramid for a renowned Paris art gallery. Mr. Pei first undertook much research into local building styles before designing the museum, and he modelled it on the shape of a North African sandstone fortress. He built with square and octagonal limestone blocks, creating 3,800 square metres of gallery space around a central courtyard. A tower with a dome rises above this middle area and lets in light through many windows. The architect would like his museum building to be regarded as a work of art in itself, as a sculpture perhaps. Inside, the museum houses 800 manuscripts, textiles, ceramics, and other works of art, which have been collected from around the world during the last 20 years. The origin of some of the artifacts is Spain, Iran, or Egypt. Other items come from Turkey and India, and some also from Central Asia. Two works of art are on display in the entrance hall: a bronze fountainhead in the shape of a deer and a brass plate from Persia. Both of these exhibits date from the 10th century. The curator of the museum states that most of the works of art in the collection have a function or a practical use. It is his hope that the museum will become a centre for research and education into the history of art in the area. Two more art museums, both connected with world-famous art galleries, are also planned as future building projects further along the coast.
That is the end of question 10 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers. Thank you, everyone.